We start today with a very, very short overview of what we've seen so far and where we are going. We started with an introduction lecture that was a mix of many different ideas, aspects, things that need to be repeated. And the basic introduction contents were looking at different building blocks and assumptions, looking at different types of definitions, and looking at what type of proofs we are considering. And so we basically looked at public key encryption and key encapsulation mechanisms. We looked at definitions of indistinguishability of ciphertexts under chosen ciphertext attacks. And we looked at reduction-based proofs and game-based definitions, and all those things are the things that we use here. There are many alternatives to that, but for such an introduction or for such a cryptography course, I think it is very easy to use those types of definitions, consider those pretty simple building blocks. But as we will move through that course here, we will see there are more complicated building blocks, other types of definitions, and those types of definitions we've seen already in the second lecture. And we might also see different types of proof techniques, but the most important ones that we will see are reduction-based proofs. In the second lecture, we have tried to understand what the system behind defining security is, what the methodology is. And the most important thing that you should take away from that lecture was that we can proceed in five steps to come up with a good definition, and those five steps are: first thing is syntax. What is the syntax again? Very good. Second step?
Correctness.
So basically trying to understand what the functionality guarantees should be, but with only honest execution environment, nothing is evil, nothing is malicious. We just look at the functionality guarantees if we wouldn't need to care about any type of security, any type of attacks. The third step, which consists of, sorry? Yeah. So the capabilities of the adversary, exactly. So we call this the adversary capabilities. That means we try to understand if we place our adversary in the, this is what you basically said, if we place an adversary in a malicious setting, what can the adversary control? What can the adversary do? How far can the adversary manipulate how the victims behave? One thing that the adversary can, for example, do, or what typically the victims can't do by themselves, is fully choose what the format of the messages look like. So there is encoding that the victims can't choose. And so we just give full power to the adversary choosing what the messages look like. Typically, the adversary is sitting on a network, can see all the ciphertexts, can see all the public keys, can see all public information, but also can manipulate traffic, which means changing ciphertext and seeing the reaction, which means that we give the adversary typically a decryption oracle. But the next question is then what to do with all these capabilities? What is. Yeah, so we need to define the goal of the adversary. And I think this is a good example to just say. Typically, or at least so far, we defined a single goal for the adversary. For authenticated public key encryption that we've used today in the exercise, we see that it can fulfill two different goals, or it can fulfill two different properties. And so it also makes sense to define two different goals for the adversary. The same holds true for authenticated encryption, so authenticated symmetric encryption, for example, with associated data. These types of primitives achieve or aim to achieve confidentiality of the payload, but also integrity and authenticity of the ciphertexts. And so there are multiple goals that an adversary can try to break. And I think aesthetically, or just also from the pedagogical perspective, it makes sense to consider each goal separately. So not try to come up with a definition that captures all these goals together, but rather define each goal individually. Because at the end, things can look very complicated, very messed up if you just combine them all together. So we just consider one goal at a time. And the final thing that we have to make sure in order to come up with a meaningful definition is... Thanks. The trivial attack. So we have to identify the trivial attacks, because there are attacks that work, at least sometimes, there are attacks that work against every construction, even the ideal construction, and these attacks, they are independent of construction information. They just work based on the syntax. They work even if you use or consider the variables, the outputs and inputs of the constructions as symbols, as abstract variables that don't even have an algebraic structure. And so it makes sense to identify these trivial attacks, because otherwise you will always have an attacker that can break any scheme. Identify these attacks, and then you come up with a construction that is No. Then you come up with a definition that is as strong as you can hope for. Because giving the adversary any more power would result again in a trivial attack. These trivial attacks, they are determined more or less on all the previous steps, on syntax, correctness, adversary capabilities, and the adversarial goal. But of course, you can strengthen the capabilities, and maybe then there are new trivial attacks, but maybe also not. So you come up with the strongest definition with respect to all the previous steps. In the third lecture, we switched again, trying to come up with something that is relevant in the real world. So definitions are just relevant in the literature, relevant for us to study things, relevant for us to make things comprehensible. Forward security is something that is really motivated in practice by having issues in implementations, by having attackers that can access secret keys on your devices, by crypt analysis that can at some point obtain access to some of the secrets, but maybe not all of them, from all of the past. And so one of the ideas of how to achieve forward security, means security even if at some point some secrets are leaked, is building forward secure key encapsulation mechanisms. We had this tree-based construction based on hierarchical identity-based encryption. Not super efficient, but very interesting. And we will see, we will keep on using similar ideas later on in the course. And then last week we looked at key exchange. The nice thing about forward secure chems was that ciphertext can just be sent. You don't have to wait for any interaction, you can just send them to your partner and you still obtain forward security. But once you can afford that there is some interaction involved, then you can use key exchange to achieve forward security, and you can even use key exchange for further guarantees like authentication. So we talked about definitions of authenticated key exchange, pretty large because your authentication key is used for many sessions, and so you have to make sure that all of those sessions are captured in one definition, and basically you have key exchange on this side and that side, so senders and receivers can be senders and receivers at any time at which they want to, and so you have multiple senders and each of them, or multiple users and each of them have multiple sessions, all of them with each other's. And finally, we looked at two very prominent constructions, signed Diffie-Hellman and key exchange based on only chems, even authenticated one. Okay, so this was the introduction. So where we are currently at is that we have some user Alice, we have some user Bob. We know how to make sure that if they interact and they want to compute a key, then they can use basically authenticated key exchange. And we know that there are things like symmetric encryption or authenticated encryption that can be used to build a channel. And we've seen a couple of building blocks and primitives that can be used for building all of those things. But our actual goal for this course is that we want to look at messaging. And so the final step before we switch to messaging that we will look at from the next lecture in 2 weeks until basically the end of that entire course is that we today look at a couple of more real-world examples. And those real-world examples include the transport layer security protocol, the noise framework, and the X3DH protocol. So the TLS protocol is probably one of the most important key exchange protocols. The noise protocol or the noise protocol framework is a suite of multiple protocols that establish channels just as TLS is doing that, but with less overhead due to cipher suite negotiation and compatibility of multiple different versions and so on and so forth. So it's basically for settings in which all of the devices that communicate together are configured the same way. So one setting where noise is used is for WhatsApp. Whenever your WhatsApp client connects to the WhatsApp server, you don't use TLS. But rather, WhatsApp knows what all of their apps are using, so they can just configure all of their devices or all of their apps the same way. And so they can just use noise instead of TLS that has all that overhead of connecting everybody with everyone in a compatible way. And the final thing that we will look at today is the X3DH protocol, and the X3DH protocol is the key exchange protocol that is used in WhatsApp and Signal and all these other messengers for communication or for initialization of communication. So when I want to talk to Bob, then my first flight, my first connection that I will make sure that I will make with Bob is made with the X3DH protocol. So basically, TLS, noise, and X3DH are the things that are used to, first of all, wrap all the information in our messaging setting to the server. So TLS is, for example, used in Signal to communicate between client and server. Noise is used for client and server communication in WhatsApp, and X3DH is used to establish a key with my communication partner through the server without the server interacting or doing anything actively. Okay, and so what I will sketch today, depending on the time, is, and what we will then start doing from next week or from next, like in 2 weeks onwards, is looking at how we can update key material. So key updates are the things that we will care about in the next couple of weeks. And the term that we use for this is ratcheted key exchange. And we will look at ratcheted key exchange from different perspectives. We will first look at definitions. We will then look at constructions. We will look at different types of two-party communication. And we will finally also look at group communication. And there will be other aspects that are not that super prominent that I should mention them here. And so this is roughly the overview of what happened so far and what will happen in the second half of this course, basically. Before I will continue, I will just give you quickly an overview of what happens basically in the actual next 4 weeks. So next week is Pfingsten. So this is free. The week afterwards May 27th is online lecture and online tutorial. Because I'm at the biggest crypto conference in Europe. And in 3 weeks, June 3rd, I will also not be here. And that's the reason why your task will be to watch conference talks. Because I'm at a workshop on key exchange. So the basic idea is, in 2 weeks I will be visible to you. You can just watch, so I will be online live with the tutorial, and also I will record the lecture, but I will also be live in the lecture. So next week, in 2 weeks, everything will be online via Zoom. I will share the Zoom link to the Studan course because I will be in Zurich at the Eurocrypt conference. The week after that is a workshop on key exchange that I will attend, which means that I won't be able to give the lecture online. But the idea is, I want you to get contact. So I did the same thing last year already, and it worked out pretty well. On YouTube, the IACR is the biggest association of cryptologic research. IACR. The IACR has a YouTube channel on which all of the conference talks from the last, I think, 10 or 15 years have been uploaded. Conference talks are typically up to 20 minutes. And the idea is that you basically watch at least 2, maybe 3 talks from a previous conference. I believe that the Eurocrypt conference talks won't be uploaded the week afterwards already. But all the other conferences from the last 5 to 10 years are online available on that YouTube channel of the IACR. You watch these talks, you look at the papers, and you try to get an impression of what the primary idea of that paper that you, or of the talk that you looked at was. Okay, IACR and YouTube. And the basic idea is you, first of all, get an idea of what is current research looking like. What are the current research questions? What are the current research topics? You can just select based on the title that you like most. There are super theoretical papers. There are rather practical papers. And I believe that you will find talks that are comprehensible for you. You can also look at the conference websites on IACR.org. And you can just check which titles are most interesting to you. And the idea is you just get a feeling of what people are doing right now in research. And those things are not too far away from what we're doing here in our lecture. Okay, and then in 4 weeks I will be back and everything is back to normal. All right, that's so far for the overview. As I said, what we did last week and now I start with the actual lecture, is we looked at key exchange. We had an introduction, we had an idea of what constructions look like, and the most important constructions that we looked at were A, signed Diffie-Hellman, and the construction more or less looks like that. G to the A, G to the B, signature of A, signature of B, where A and B are randomly sampled, and the signature of A is using the signing key of Alice, and it signs G to the A and G to the B. And the signature of Bob signs with the signing key of, no, sorry. Just gave those two things wrong names, sorry. This is the signature of Bob, and this is the signature of Alice. And this one signs G to the A, G to the B, and the signature of Bob. Okay, so this is the basic idea of signed Diffie-Hellman, and this thing is secure. Under strong unforgeability, under chosen message attacks for the signature scheme, and the DDH assumption for the Diffie-Hellman group. And the second construction idea was chem-based authentication. And chem-based authentication primarily looks as follows. We have Alice and Bob, and Alice sends to Bob first ciphertext and a public key. Bob responds with two ciphertexts and a tag, a message authentication code. And Alice responds with the final message authentication code back. And so the basic idea is that Alice uses her knowledge of Bob's public key. So she uses a chem. To Bob's public key, and she also generates a fresh chem key pair. And Bob on his side first decapsulates the key. With his secret key. And then he encapsulates to the long-term public key of Alice and to the ephemeral public key of Alice. And finally, all of these keys are bound together with a tag. With a pseudorandom function. And the pseudorandom function uses k1 and a tag that consists of c1 the public key that was sent over the wire, c2 and c3. And also Alice will at the end compute a T, compute first of all the same tag and then also her own tag with a key. And this will look as follows. She will compute the final key. And the tag TA. And for this, she will use this KB that was just previously computed, as well as K2 and K3. And so the final key that both users will compute is this key that also Bob will compute. And the basic idea is that all of the symmetric key operations are computed on both sides. So this tag B here will be computed on both sides such that Alice can verify that this tag was computed correctly. And also Bob will compute this tag A to make sure that this tag A that was sent over the wire was computed correctly. And now the basic idea of this construction is first of all to make sure things are authentic, but also make sure that things are confidential. And with confidential, we don't only mean that things are permanently confidential if nothing bad happens, but also if some of the information that was used was ever corrupted. And so first of all, what we can write down is that this construction is secure if the chem is INDCCA secure, and we have a multi-key PRF. And before we move on with the things that we want to capture in today's lecture, we briefly look at why things are forward secure. So forward secure was one of the main motivations for why we were looking or why we were starting with forward secure chem. Then we started introducing interaction. One thing that we wanted to make sure was forward security, and the other one was authenticity. So for Scientific-Hellman, things are pretty clearly separated. Forward security is made sure by just letting Alice and Bob generate their ephemeral exponents for the Diffie-Hellman key exchange to be generated freshly and being removed immediately after the key exchange is over. And the signatures are used for making sure that things are authentic, so that only Alice can send things that Bob will accept as being sent by Alice and vice versa. The question for chem-based authentication is not so obvious, and so let's quickly look at what happens if Alice and Bob are corrupted. Okay, so let's check. Forward security means even if all the secrets are ever corrupted, nothing bad happens. So why is this chem-based authentication key exchange, why does that offer forward security? This is the most high-level question to which you can give most answers, but what we first of all see is, of course, the adversary can watch the entire traffic that is sent over the wire. This is clear. What else would the adversary see? So if Alice is corrupted, her secret key is corrupted. So which keys are then known to the attacker if Alice's secret key is corrupted? I want quick answers.
Everything on the side of tunnels.
So let's make sure corruption happens at some point after the protocol terminates. So at some point here, corruption happens, which means that either secret key of Alice or secret key of Bob or both of them are corrupted. And so what is affected by that? We do not consider the corruption of ephemeral key material because basically we just assume that these sessions are just super short term. Key exchange is over, everything is erased, and we are happy. But of course, due to the corruption of Alice and Bob, some of the keys, if the adversary saw the traffic on the network, are inevitably leaked to the attacker. And what are those keys? Let's start with the things that are affected by a corruption of Alice. Mm-hmm. Key two. Oh, sorry. Wrong color. So key two. Why key two? It's encapsulated to the public key of Alice. And so if the adversary knows the secret key of Alice, of course, the adversary by correctness can decapsulate K2. Okay. K3, I don't agree with you. Because K3 was generated just freshly, and it will be erased immediately after the session is over. Okay, what happens if Bob is corrupted? Which keys are known to the attacker if Bob's key is corrupted? Just say it. K1. And that basically means also this KB here. But as we see, now we used almost all colors. K3 is protected by the secrecy of SK prime, and so K3 is also part of the final key computation. And so just by that, we have that the final key is secure as long as the secret key that is just ephemerally generated and then afterwards removed stays secure and is never leaked to the attacker. So this was about forward security. Authenticity, why is this thing authentic? Authenticity means that nobody besides the user who is sending things should be able to impersonate that user. Basically, no impersonation happens. And we want to make sure that if everybody except for Alice is corrupted, so as long as Alice is not corrupted, nobody should be able to impersonate Alice. So how do we make sure that this happens, that this is indeed achieved? The basic idea is, does anybody see it maybe, or we can just briefly go over it. The basic idea is that Alice is the only one who knows secret key of Alice. So the secret key to this public key here. So she's the only one who knows this K2. Because as long as she is not corrupted, public key A, so the encapsulation to public key A with this key 2 here cannot be decapsulated by anybody except for herself. And so the only one who can compute this tag here, tag A, is the user who knows this K2. And K2 is only known to her. So basically, instead of using signatures for authenticating, this protocol here uses the ability to decapsulate for authentication. And the same holds true for the other way around. The key that is encapsulated to Bob, which is K1, is only known to Bob. And so K1 here is only known to that user who knows the secret key of B. And so using that key makes sure that Bob basically proves that he is the one who knows the secret key of B by sending this tag B. And so again, we have authentication by the ability of decapsulating and then using it with the PRF to prove to the other party that you're online and that you're the one who owns the secret key of Bob. And of course, if Alice and Bob are corrupted before that, we cannot guarantee anything. This is independent of whether we use signatures or if we use decapsulation or whatever means of authentication. Okay, that was about real-world public key encrypt or real-world key, key exchange protocols. Any questions on that? Nothing. Okay. Optimal. Then we switch to today's lecture. Real world authenticated key exchange. Okay, so there are many, many, many protocols in the real world that are used for authenticated key exchange. The most prominent one is TLS that we will look at in a second. Transport layer security. But there are other protocols like SSH, IPsec, and so on and so forth. And they are not all the same. They are partially different. And the thing is, due to being less used than TLS, the others are also less frequently considered in academic literature by attacks and so on and so forth. And so that means that the trust in these protocols is slightly weaker than the trust in, for example, TLS. So TLS is the main example of research, is the main use case for making studies on how secure things are, how a responsible disclosure works, of provable security analyses of all these different cipher suits, which is not the case for other protocols like SSH and IPsec. The basic idea of transport layer security, at least in the current version, TLS 1.3, is signed Diffie-Hellman. So it's basically nothing else than the sender sends some G to the X, and typically the sender is some client that doesn't authenticate, if the client authenticates, then of course there can be an authentication mechanism involved. Then the server responds with some G to the Y and a signature. And at the end, we have a key confirmation. With G to the XY. This is the most prominent use case on a very, very high abstraction layer. And there are many pseudorandom functions, key derivation functions, and so on involved. And there is actually also a key update mechanism to make sure that we have, for long-term sessions, secure keys with respect to the past. There are session resumption mechanisms to make sure that if you established a session 1 week ago, then you can go back to that session, use the same key, and just update it to maintain the authenticity that you already obtained, and that you can that you do not need to reintroduce signatures and make things inefficient just by having more interaction necessary. So there are many, many tools that are implemented in transport layer security and many, many features that we do not have to worry, that we do not want to care about. But the high level perspective is transport layer security is basically signed Diffie-Hellman key exchange. The second thing that we briefly talked about today is the noise framework. And the noise framework is or can be thought of as a set of rules. To combine Diffie-Hellman key exchange. With authenticated encryption. As I said, this is used in WhatsApp for client to server. It is also used in the, or one of the patterns is used in the WireGuard VPN protocol. And the most important aspect is it is very flexible, similarly flexible as TLS, but much more lightweight. Because pre-configured the setting or all of the variables, all of the cipher suits that are used, all of the basically the entire protocol is configured for homogeneous networks. Okay, and so to give you an idea of what that looks like, try to copy this picture here. So this is basically the core of the noise framework. It is, as I said, a set of rules, maybe not too easy to see what I'm talking about right now. So there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times 2, so 10. Is that correct? No. 12 different patterns. 12 different patterns, and these patterns depend on what does each of the two parties who are communicating know about the other party. So either I, as the client, know the server is public key, and so I want to establish a connection with a server whose public key I know, or I, as the initiator, know nothing about the other party, so maybe the other party needs to send me their public key, or I know that user and I want to immediately use this information not only once throughout the protocol, but immediately. Or the other party does not have a long-term public key, so there is no authentication of the long-term key. And so this is basically what the names for these key exchanges are. So NN means no static key for either of the two party. It's just basically a Diffie-Hellman key exchange, nothing else. So ephemeral, so EE means there is an ephemeral Diffie-Hellman key exchange between the two parties. And on the other side, KK, for example, means both parties have a long-term key and both parties know the other party's long-term key. This is, I don't know, we have a pre-configured setting, we know who we're talking about, so both parties know each other, and we can use the knowledge of the other party's public key immediately. While XX, for example, is a setting in which both parties can be authenticated with their public key, but neither of both parties know the public key of the other party in advance. This is like a WhatsApp setting. I know the other party and the other party knows, no. I know who I want to talk with, but I don't know the public key of the other party yet, so we will exchange that public key at some point, and the other party has the same situation, more or less. The most important setting that I would say is relevant to the internet, where clients don't have any long-term public key, but servers do have long-term public keys, and the clients know the server's long-term public key, is this NK setting. So the user has no long-term key, but the user knows the long-term public key of the server. So this is the reason why we will quickly look at the example of NK. And those are just the names of the key exchanges that are possible with the noise framework. There are many other options with pre-shared keys and so on and so forth. So it's similarly powerful as TLS, but the point is you do not have to do negotiation and all the other parameter finding and cipher suit negotiation and so on at the very beginning. So let's look at the example of the NK key exchange protocol that is specified by the noise framework. Okay, so what Alice begins with is she starts to sample a random exponent, X, and then she computes a key with that exponent and the public key that she knows already. And this is key K1. And we basically call this here G to the XB. And so the first ciphertext that she sends to Bob is her own ephemeral public key, G to the X, and an encryption of the first message that she wants to send together with the key that she just computed. That's the other point of this protocol. It allows for encryption as soon as a key is established, and since this is basically just public key encryption, we already know, like, we have a public key of the receiver. We can use it for public key encryption, and so we do it. We just send, if we want to, with the first flight, a message. As soon as Bob receives this, Bob will compute a second key, K2, and this K2 will use the PRF with the first key and G to the XY. And for this, he will first sample a fresh exponent Y. And now the second ciphertext looks as follows. We will first use encryption under the key that is already established. And then Bob will send his ephemeral public key to Alice encrypted. That's the other feature of the noise framework. As soon as encryption is possible, we will use it to protect all the information that we want to protect. And so the ephemeral public key is one thing that we can protect, so why shouldn't we just do it? But once the information on the sender side, on Alice's side, is available, what key to use for the next encryption step, we will use the next encryption step. So K2 is used together with the second payload message. So for all the other messages that will be encrypted at some later point, we will use K2 and that's the whole point of that first, of that example NK here. Mm-hmm.
How does Bob, or the one on the right side, get K1?
Using the own secret key. And the G to the X, which should be G to the X. So this here is K1 is PRF of the public key of Bob raised to the power of X. G to the X is sent over to Bob. And so we just do the Diffie-Hellman key exchange with the secret key of Bob and X. Mm-hmm. Okay. We see here that there are very few protocols, namely those two, that use the static-static Diffie-Hellman key exchange. So ephemeral, or everything with E is an ephemeral thing. And whenever you see two letters, that means that a Diffie-Hellman key exchange is performed. So in the protocol that we just see here, there are two Diffie-Hellman key exchanges, one with the between the ephemeral of the sender and the static of the receiver, and one between the two ephemeral Diffie-Hellman key exchanges. And as I just said, there are two protocols that use the static-static Diffie-Hellman key exchange. And maybe you have an idea of why it makes sense to sometimes avoid doing a Diffie-Hellman key exchange and using the Diffie-Hellman key exchange between the static key shares of senders and receivers. Do you have an idea of what property is achieved by that? The reason is, and I'm actually not the biggest fan of that, but people in the community, some people in the community and some people on the internet, and I do understand their motivation, but I don't think that this particular property is really relevant, is deniability. Maybe you have heard of deniability. Deniability is the ability to say, I wasn't involved here. So basically, I send you a message and you can't say that I was actually the one who was sending you that message. Or put differently, Alice and Bob communicate with each other, and then at some point someone steals their phone and checks who Bob communicated with, and then all the traffic that is seen on that device does not produce enough information to prove that Alice and Bob were the ones who were communicating. But as soon as you have a Diffie-Hellman key exchange between Alice and Bob, and that Diffie-Hellman key exchange is used by Alice and Bob, then it can be possible at some point to claim and to prove that Alice and Bob were actually involved in that communication. And so as long as you avoid that, as long as you avoid using G2AB, but you have other means of making sure that still authenticity is achieved. So authenticity and deniability do not contradict each other fundamentally. There are some cases in which they contradict each other. But in particular, if you do G2AB, it will become pretty hard to achieve deniability. And how you typically prove that something is deniable is by saying that the transcript can be simulated without access to the secret key of A, respectively secret key of B. And then finally, a few comments. On the security guarantees that this protocol achieves. So on the first stage, this protocol achieves or the properties that we are looking for are particularly forward security, authenticity, and anonymity. And the question is, how far are they achieved? And how far means with respect to whom? With respect to sender or receiver, or what we call them typically is initiator or responder. So forward security in the first message, or in the first stage, we call this here a stage. So for whom do we achieve forward security? Or with respect to whose secret key? And the second question would then be, with respect to whose identity do we achieve authenticity? And who remains anonymous? So, first, let's call them the responder. Achieves authenticity here already. So it means, in that sense at least, that only the responder is able to receive things. And then in the second stage, we will also be able to say that only the responder was the one who was able to actually respond. Forward secure, yeah? For the sender, exactly. And anonymity for both for responder only until corruption. And from the second stage on, we have forward security for both users, because as soon as also Bob generates or the responder generates their own ephemeral secret and that is used, then we have security for both users. You can take a look at the Noise Protocol Framework online. It's a huge website with a lot of information about different properties for all these different. So basically for each of these protocols and for many other protocols, you can see at which stage you achieve which properties. And it is also, like there are many different implementations, it's super easy to use, super easy to understand, and that's the basic idea. It's by Trevor Perrin. Who is also the inventor or one of the two inventors of the of Signal's messaging protocol and of the X3DH protocol that we will look at next. And who is regularly climbing with me. So he's a super nice guy, also in private. But yeah, primarily pretty good real-world cryptographer. He's not an academic, he's not a professor or anything, he's just a freelancing cryptography person who is putting projects online that are really useful in practice. And yeah, the Noise Protocol Framework is one of them, and the other one is, as I said, the X3DH protocol that is primarily used by all of the messaging protocols that use modern primitives. One exception is Threema, who invented more or less a replacement for that, which is the, I think, 4DH protocol or something. So it's more or less the same, but with interesting differences, with stronger authenticity guarantees, but without deniability, more or less. Okay, so the basic idea of X3DH is that it is an extended and authenticated two-pass key exchange. And it's typically used as the initial key exchange with the double ratchet that we will look at in the next couple of weeks. And to properly understand how the X3DH protocol works, we have to understand that the real world looks a little bit more complicated than our models and our super easy and abstract definitions. The first thing that we see, you will see in a couple of seconds why it is called the X3DH protocol. First of all, it is based on Diffie-Hellman. So Diffie-Hellman is the thing, the DH at the end. Alice and Bob both have long-term keys. So Alice has an exponent capital A and the G to the A. And also Bob has a long-term key. B and G to the B. And although typically we use capital letters for the full Diffie-Hellman share, this is just a break with notation for this particular example. I hope you can accept that. There are more keys that Alice and Bob produce, and we are just looking at the session initialization from Alice to Bob. So Alice will start a communication with Bob. And for this, Alice, the only thing that Alice needs in the long run is Alice's long-term key. But Bob has more keys. So Bob has a pre-key, which is also a Diffie-Hellman share. And for this, we use beta and g to the beta. And finally, Bob has one time keys. And with keys, I mean that Bob really has multiple of those. And all of them are uploaded to the server. The interesting part here is that they are uploaded and refreshed with different frequency. So the long-term key is just uploaded once. It is generated once, it is uploaded once. The pre-key is uploaded once upon a time, maybe a couple once every couple of weeks or once every couple of months. And then there are one-time keys that are uploaded once they have been used. So I will upload maybe 50 one-time keys, and as soon as 40 of them have been used, I will upload another 40, just to make sure that there are always one-time keys available. So these circles here just mean different frequencies. And so as soon as Alice wants to start communicating with Bob, she will download all three items. And she will generate an own exponent. And so now we come to why this thing is called X3DH protocol. This is because now we have five keys with which we can do Diffie-Hellman key exchanges. And if we connect all of them, then we have a full Diffie-Hellman key exchange with all possible combinations, but we don't do that because one of the properties that the X3DH protocol wants to achieve is deniability. And so what we do is, first of all, the short-term exponent, or the short-term Diffie-Hellman share of Alice, is used with all three options. And the last one is only used if a one-time key of Bob is indeed available, which is typically the case, but it could be that Bob hasn't been online for a long time, and so Bob didn't upload new one-time keys, but Alice still wants to start a communication, and nevertheless, I don't know, Bob was on vacation for an entire month, and there were many interesting people that Bob was meeting along that vacation, but Bob didn't turn on his phone, and so all the people that he got in touch with during his vacation started a conversation with Bob, and so they all consumed one of the one-time keys, and now the last person didn't get a one-time key anymore, but still there is a pre-key, and there is the long-term key with which Alice can do a Diffie-Hellman key exchange. So those four combinations are the ones that will fill the Diffie-Hellman key exchange that is used for establishing the first key in a communication between Alice and Bob. So Alice will compute the PRF, and this PRF will be filled with G to the AB, where A is lowercase and B is uppercase, G to the A beta, and G to the A lowercase b. And she will do a G to the uppercase A beta. Once she did that, she will send her her ephemeral Diffie-Hellman shared G to the A, where lowercase a is the one that she's using. And she will encrypt with the key her first message and will set the associated data to G to the A. And so the properties that we get from that are strong forward security, authenticity, and deniability. So as you see here, this is three Diffie-Hellman key exchanges at least, maybe four, and it's an X between the long term and the short term or medium term Diffie-Hellman shares. And this is basically the idea. So we achieve something that is on the performance level, or at least on the usability level, pretty close to our forward secure chem, because we just basically have one flight. We just have one pass, just have one interaction. Everything else is used or everything else is maintained and made sure via the server. So the server is maintaining, hosting all the information that can be stored without interaction of Bob. But once this communication starts, Alice can send her ciphertext immediately to Bob without waiting for an interaction. So Bob basically prepares everything that is necessary for communication and stores it and caches it on the server. Okay, so those are the three examples that I wanted to briefly talk about. And we will now jump into everything that happens after such an initialization of the communication starts. And that is why we talk about ratcheted key exchange. The first thing to be noticed is that ratcheted key exchange is an abstraction. Of signals double ratchet protocol. For two-party messaging. And it was defined by Bellari et al. So Mihir Bellari, we heard about Mihir Bellari last week already, key exchange model, Phil Rogoway and Mihir Bellari. Mihir Bellari is a researcher working at UC San Diego. Interesting person, very kind person, and worked together a lot with Phil Rogoway. Both of them were students of Silvio Micali. And many other super important people were students of Silvio Micali. And Silvio Micali was a student of, now I don't know the first name of Blum, Manuel Blum, Manuel Blum. And so I think all of them, or at least Manuel Blum and Silvio Micali, are Turing Award winners by now. So super interesting people, super kind people. And yeah, Mihir Bellari and Phil Rogoway were some of the people who influenced our perspective on how to define and understand real-world cryptographic protocols. And so it's not a surprise that Bellari was the first one who tried to understand what the double ratchet protocol is doing on a level that makes it accessible for our provable security. Because there was a study, there was a study on the double ratchet protocol 1 year before the paper by Bellari et al. So the paper by Bellari et al. Is from Crypto 2017, and it is called Ratcheted Key Exchange and I think encryption . So this paper is from 2017, and they just considered a very, very high level notion of ratcheted key exchange that we will look at in a second. But there was a paper 1 year before that that tried to come up with a security proof of the double ratchet protocol. But this security proof, if you look at it, is very, very hard to understand, because they tried to capture everything, including the X3DH protocol and the full Diffie-Hellman key exchange and all of the other things that are involved in the double ratchet protocol. But this didn't come with a clean definition and a clean separation and modularization of the components. And so Bellari et al. Was the one who made it accessible and whose definitions we basically work with today. There was an extension, so as I said, so Bellari et al. Looked at a very simple version. I will explain these three versions in a second. So there are three variants. And the first one that Bellari et al. Considered was unidirectional. Ratcheted key exchange, which is basically Alice will always send to Bob, but Bob will never respond. And so there was a paper by a colleague of mine who works at IBM today. Bertram Pottering and myself. And we extended this at Crypto 2018. To the remaining three variants that make it a little bit more practical or relevant, or like it captures more what we have in practice, I would say, like that. So this paper is called Asynchronous Ratcheted Key Exchange. And so what we added, with the final goal of having bidirectional, in which Alice and Bob interact with each other more or less, no, not only more or less, but really symmetrically, we have an intermediate step that we call sesqui. Directional ratcheted key exchange. And the idea here is that still Alice is the only one who sends, but Bob can also partially interact with Alice. And we will see in a second what that means. For simplicity, in this course, we will focus on unidirectional ratcheted key exchange, but the ideas can be translated and extended if you look at it for long enough time. But I think it makes much more sense to stay on that lower level to understand all these components, all these ideas in a simpler setting. So we have Alice and Bob. And what we did already is we have some initial key exchange. And this initial key exchange makes sure that we have authentication and we establish a key between Alice and Bob that is symmetric, and we even have forward security, so even if 5 years afterwards, Alice or Bob are corrupted, still the key is secure and we are happy. And now the interesting part is that we start after that with a session protocol. And a session protocol is something that only runs between Alice and Bob. So the initial key exchange protocol that was involved with starting communications with all the users that I ever want to start a communication with. But now our session protocol is the thing that we are interested in right now. And so that session protocol starts with an initialization. And that session protocol generates a state for Alice and for Bob. And we can just assume that there is that the key that Alice and Bob will use, they will both use the init algorithm, and that init algorithm takes the key and produces a state for Alice and a state for Bob. And instead of assuming that the key is given, we could also just say that algorithm runs probabilistically without any inputs. And now the idea is that Alice has her state and Bob has his state. Or put differently, what Alice and Bob could do is they could just ignore the other party's state when executing the init algorithm. And now what such a unidirectional ratcheted key exchange protocol is doing is it does the following. It has a send algorithm that produces a state, a key, and a ciphertext, and takes as input the state of Alice. And now you see here what we've seen for forward secure key encapsulation mechanisms. Alice takes her own state, but she also updates her state. So she makes sure that some forward security guarantees are met. Things that were in here should not be in here anymore. When here things are corrupted here, should be forgotten already with respect to the previous state. So we just give Alice the ability to forget things. But she always also is doing something that a chem would be doing, which is establishing a key and outputting a ciphertext. So the ciphertext is sent to Bob. Her previous state is used. The key is used for something that we will see in a second, for a channel, for example. But before we look at all these things, Bob will first use his receive algorithm to compute the same key. And now one option to use all these things would be to build a symmetric channel through which payload messages are sent from Alice to Bob. And that channel basically uses the keys that Alice and Bob establish. But as I said, we want to make sure that things are regularly updated. We want to have strong forward security, and so Alice and Bob regularly repeat this operation. So Alice uses her state to compute another state, another key, and another ciphertext. And Bob tries to compute the same key by updating his state when receiving with his previous state the ciphertext. and so on and so forth. We will see in the next couple of weeks why this thing is called ratcheted key exchange. A ratchet is basically a mechanism like a ratche to make sure that a chain only goes through this ratchet in one direction. And this corresponds basically to the forward security guarantees that this update mechanism is continuously giving us. So we are just focusing on the init algorithm that outputs a state, the send algorithm that updates the state, outputs a key, and outputs a ciphertext that the receive algorithm is taking to compute the same key and also update the state. And now finally, before I will end today's class, I will copy something from my sketch, which is, I would be super happy if you and everybody who watches the videos online and actively participates in this course would fill out this form here. This will also be, of course, in the uploaded script, but I want to make sure that only those who participate will participate. So only those who watch and interact will participate to tell me what you think so far about the course. There will be a final evaluation that is formal. This one is here just run by myself. Since I will be evaluated after a couple of years based on your feedback, I would like to know your feedback, and of course I want to make this course useful and meaningful. And so if you have any feedback that you want to let me know, so which things should be kept the way they are, which things should be changed, what are you expecting, what would help you even more, and so on and so forth, I would be super happy if you could fill out this form within the next 2 weeks until the next lecture in 2 weeks. So please just take at most 10 minutes. I think even 5 minutes would be sufficient to just fill out that form to make sure that I have an idea of what you think about the course so far. Then with that, I will just let you know that from next week on, we will try to identify what are the definitions, what are security guarantees that we can expect from that. This will be next lecture. And the lecture afterwards, we will talk about constructions. There is an exercise about proving the authenticated public key encryption scheme from last week's lecture. And this will be everything for the next 2 weeks. Enjoy the Pfingstferien. Thank you very much for your attention.